Welcome to the Right to Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins, and I'm in a rainy Hammersmith with my colleagues Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Jasper Mewerson Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
Joining us for episode 174 is one of our very, very favourite people and one of our very favourite musicians, Mr. Sean O'Hagan. Welcome, Sean.
Hello, everybody.
Not to be confused, of course, with the enemy, an Observer writer who has become the sort of James Boswell to Nick Cave's Samuel Johnson. Sean is the leader of the High Llamas, the former guitarist with Micro Disney, sometime member of Stereolab, and the arranger of many beautiful things for Super Furry Animals, Paul Weller, Bunny Prince Billy, etc. A long list of clients for your arranging talents. You are a veritable renaissance man of popular music, Sean. It's lovely to have you here.
Sorry.
The first Llamas album in 8 years is just out, or will be out by the time this episode goes live. It's called Hey Panda, and it's absolutely wonderful. We will get to that a little bit later, but we are going to go back to the very beginning of your musical odyssey. And so what I believe you grew up in or near Luton, is that correct? So where did music begin for you, Sean, in Luton?
I guess at secondary school, just like most kids, you invariably at secondary school you fall into one of two camps. You're aggressive and protected, or you're not aggressive and you're unprotected.
Yes.
And we non-aggressive, unprotected young people just disappeared into music. I mean, it was basically the only medium that you could find any solace. And so music was very, very, very important. Yeah, so that's probably where it happened. That's the start.
That's an instantly recognisable thing.
Yes.
He said feeling the bruises from the skin.
Yeah, exactly. What was the first music that you really kind of fell in love with?
Okay. I do have memories of things like, what's his name? I cannot remember the name of the artist, but Tony James, maybe. And Vagabonds, is it? Moaney, Moaney on My Pony.
Tommy James and Chandelles.
That's the first song that really sort of got into my head as a little kid. Yeah. I remember that. So that's interesting. I remember really connecting with Mums and Papas as a little boy. And my nose was the same height as the radio, which was on an electric fire heater, a Murphy fire heater. And I remember my nose being on the, you know, and the Mamas and Papas. But then my own choices, weird, really weird. Things like My Sweet Lord, George Harrison, obviously. Really, really now funny thing is having an Irish background and spending your youth, you know, like your first sort of 7 years in Ireland, you can't escape it. So things like Horselips, you know, very, very important.
Sure. Yeah.
Because it was heritage. Oh, they're Irish and they're cool.
With an electric mandolin.
Exactly. So those things, and Horselips sort of brought me into like things like Steel Ice Band. But those things didn't last very long. I quickly sort of jumped over to, you know, what was happening in you know, out there, be it sort of, oh wow, what a Black Sabbath, they're unusual, wow. What the hell is that? And so all that the rock stuff and the glam stuff was happening, and I was aware of it. But quietly, what I really, really loved was things like Temptations, Ball of Confusion, Supremes, those later hits. Of course, I'm exactly the right age for British reggae as well. Johnny Seven, Double Decker.
Just
came to my head.
Yeah.
That's big.
Yeah.
And so as a kid, that's big.
Right.
And then you get a bit older and you start getting a bit whatever, and suddenly things like, you know, like Jackson Brown and Steely Dan start to emerge. haven't really. I know about the Beach Boys at this stage, but I'm embarrassed by the Beach Boys like everybody else is. The thing about the Beach Boys is most people, you know, now the book's been rewritten, but back
then,
everybody was just embarrassed by them because of the way they looked, because they were brothers, because of this, because of that. And so I was aware of them, but I hadn't really discovered the deep well of brilliance. That came when I was like, you know, like 18, 19.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you not read, say, Nick Kent's like huge piece about Brian Wilson in
1975.
The NME?
Yeah, no, I wasn't allowed to read the NME. I was
by whom? Were you not allowed?
By my mother.
Right.
I sold it because my mum ran a kiosk.
You were allowed to read it.
Really? I sold it, but I wasn't allowed to read it.
Fair enough.
Think it was possibly because they had women's bearing their. Their breasts on
Well, not sort of all, yeah.
And my mother.
Put pictures of women's breasts into the NME.
Yeah. In the
Livest.
In the Gig Guide.
Yeah. Just utterly gratuitous.
My mother got all the top shelf magazines removed from the kiosk.
What a good mum.
A good Catholic girl.
Yeah. Okay, so when, did you furtively sort of sneak a copy into your bedroom at some point?
Oh, NME?
Yeah.
I probably didn't really start seeing the NME properly until like late 76. So Nick Kent was still very important, but he was already losing a little bit of ground, wasn't he?
By 76, I think it's pretty fair to say. But I mean, I mentioned the Brian Wilson piece because it was one of those kind of moments where I realised how great the Beach Boys were. I mean, I loved Good Vibration stuff, but suddenly I realised that Nick Kent was taking the Beach Boys incredibly seriously, and particularly Brian.
Yeah, and I think in that piece, isn't that the piece where he actually visits Brian in situ?
Yeah.
And I think doesn't he witness a party whereby everybody who's, I don't know, 1975, everybody who's cool at the time, I don't know who it is Don Henley or God knows, Joni Mitchell. I think they're at a party and Brian turns up at the party and he starts and he says, let's all have a sing-song. And they all sit around and they're like, oh, great, we're going to have Brian's, whatever. And he starts to play, Mama's got shortening, you know, again, embarrassing everybody. Oh my God, you know, poor Brian. Mm. So, so brilliant. He always floors people.
And obviously at a certain point your family moves, back to Ireland? So were your parents like first generation immigrants?
Yeah, they were from County Louth and, the usual, no work in Ireland. So dad goes over, gets a job in the car factory, mum follows and becomes a nurse, you know?
Yeah.
Just the, you know, that story, you know.
Sure. So why did you move back?
Because you always have the dream of moving back.
Right.
And we didn't go back to County Louth because my mother said, we're relative failures, so we can't go back to where we came from. We have to go somewhere new. So we went to Cork. And that's why we ended up in Cork in, 76, I guess.
Okay. And then 4 years later you meet Cahill.
Yeah, 4 years later. The eve of 79 into 1980, New Year's Eve, I meet Cahill. Yeah, absolutely. And very, very important because up to then, so I've got a very working class background. Dad works in car factory, mum, nursing, Catholic comprehensive school. I haven't met anybody who's middle class, you know. No, and these things, this seems unusual. Back then, it's not unusual. You know, you didn't know what an avocado was. You hadn't met middle class people, and
that's the definition.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah.
Yes.
And certainly in Luton, certainly completely segregated.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in Cork, because Cork is this incredible little, this small city that's parochial and isolated, it's got a whole cultural sort of drive and being of its own.
Mm.
And Ireland is full of people who, so sure, you have middle classes and working classes in Ireland, but everybody has something to say. And because of that, the conversations happen. And because of that, you actually do meet middle class people. And that's kind of, I went to a party, college kids, for the first time in my life, and I met Cahill, and it was amazing.
And you bonded with him straight away, didn't you?
Mainly because the thing that he, like, late 79, people in Cork are listening to Neil Young, Joni Mitchell. Cork is still basically hanging on to the hippie dream.
Right.
And there's a lot of hippies there, and a lot of them said, you know, sod this, we're going to the West Cork, you know, a lot of German hippies. And so it's big there. And by this time, I had already heard the pop group and Skritti Politti, and right. I was really, really interested. I was becoming really... Because I wasn't really interested in the rock and roll side of punk. I didn't get it. I didn't. Why are people so excited about, you know, four guys, guitar, bass and drums? But when I heard people who weren't playing kind of what I thought was just kind of quite the music I'd heard before, who were playing sort of distant music, angular music, and shouting in strange ways, I was interested, even though I was listening to Steely Dan at the same time. And so we started to talk about the Mekons, Skritti, and a pop group. And Carl said, there's about three people in this city who know this stuff.
Yes,
wow. And that was it. And we just had the most fantastic time. And we literally said, let's meet, you know, on Monday. I mean, he was studying medicine at college, and I was loading containers with lasagna and ravioli, and I just thought, and my world just a light bulb went on. I brightened, and I went, "Yeah, I'm going to be in a room with somebody. I'm actually going to make music." I could play guitar. I taught myself to play guitar when I was about 14 or 15.
Yes.
I had a telly. I had this beautiful old telly, which I bought from a guy from... There's a show band, and the guy, they basically retired. They had this beautiful, like, early 60s telly. Wow. And a Vox amp. I bought that, and I went... And he... I don't know... Oh, we rented my sister... In my sister's school, a prefab in my sister's school, we rented a prefab for a morning, and I hit the guitar, and he shouted poetry.
Yeah.
And that's the start.
Right.
That was the start.
Kernel.
And then that was it.
Yeah.
That was it for a lifetime.
He'd grown up in Cork.
He'd grown up in Glentorne, which is a little village outside Cork. His mother was a school teacher. His father worked for the Department of Agriculture. It was the Irish middle class, which is, you know, quite... So education was important, family was important, and, you know... Irish Catholic values are important.
Yes.
So that was his background. So he was kicking back at that quite heavily.
Yes.
Yeah. And continue to do so.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking like 10 days or so after this film about Micro Disney premiered on the BBC.
Sure.
And, you know, you went to the premiere. Yeah. I've watched it on iPlayer. Mm. And it's quite a moving thing, obviously. Because Carl's no longer
indeed,
with us.
I mean, that event, the showing, was kind of a mixture of real happiness at seeing the band celebrated and a real sadness.
Yeah.
Of Carl's absence.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, because we lost him a couple of years ago, and there was obviously, you know, a lot of people, it was noted, it was pretty much everywhere, people did know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't then follow up with, as happens a lot of the time, with celebrations and gigs and things like that to celebrate the memory of, then I think possibly this event was the first time there was this real coming together of people who kind of lived their life with Carl and experienced the sort of the loss and tribute to him, really.
Yeah.
There probably will be, you know... celebrations and gigs, you know, down the line. But me and Cahill's Julie, his wife, was married to Julie, we both said we don't want to do that right now.
Right.
You know, we just don't want to get drawn into any of that.
Mm. I mean, what's wonderful is that you did have the reunion in 2019.
Incredible.
The Barbican shows which I went to, which is fabulous.
And, I was... wow, I mean, God, the fact that those happened was just like manna from heaven. The fact that Gary Sheehan in Ireland and Paul McDermott, who's a very interesting guy, an archivist in Ireland, engineered that. And it was something that we would normally wouldn't do. We basically, we religiously said, well, we're not going to get involved in that. because we, by this time, we had re-established a relationship. Carl had sung on my solo album. Yeah. Carl was in my house an awful lot.
Yeah.
You know, I spoke about how Carl was like this angry, very young man who was angry, and he was. Mark was in the room for a long time with us.
Yes.
And he saw that. But Carl in his later life was this he was stupidly humble and ferociously intelligent guy. So totally humble, very insightful, and he loved it. He never had kids himself, but he loved his family, like his brothers and sisters and the extended family. He looked after his mother into her last years. And he spent an awful lot of time in my house with me and my kids. And we had this great second part of our relationship, which was as adults enjoying the sort of the full life experience, so to speak.
I was so pleased to see that because, I mean, Mike recently broke up with some acrimony, it's fair to say. And it was quite a long gap when you really didn't see
him. No, yeah, there was a silence.
So it was just lovely to see you guys in the last few years of his life.
Mm.
You know, being great friends again, and then starting to make music together again as well.
Yeah. And we kept it very strict. We said I think we did in all on the reunions. We did about 4 shows, and that was it. And we absolutely said no, we're not touring. We're not making records, we're not doing any of that, we're doing this because I don't know, I just, but because 2 things. First of all, I had a career. Carl was making records. He'd just basically made, and was about to make his probably most successful solo album, and he was about to embark on Telefiche, a collaboration with Jack Knife Lee in LA. And you know, we both had other things. We had contemporary careers, and so we said no. We both are living in the present.
Yes.
Sounds really nice to sort of do it on your own terms in that sense. Not, you know, there's not sort of pressure of doing endless shows and whatever, but just having fun with it for yourselves.
The pressure comes from other people saying, this is payday after, you know, you're ignored. Now you can get, you know.
Yes.
But really, I think the most important thing is the music that you made at the time, the history that you created at the time, and keeping that history relevant, you know, because obviously sometimes, I'm sad to say that, the history that was there does get sort of lost slightly, you know, when it becomes an industry.
What was it like to perform that music again, that obviously you're different people, you have a different relationship, and it was music that was of the time when you made it? And what was it like going back to that?
Very, very good question. So first of all, we had the 4-piece, John Fell, Tommy Fenner, and myself, and Carl. We were the nub of the band, the kernel of the band. The keyboard player for the new shows was Roger Marsden. Incredible guy. I did try to get Mark involved. I did sort of think about whether you wanted to join us, because Mark did actually play keyboards a number of times.
Well, mostly the El Grey Whistle Test.
Mostly the El Grey Whistle Test.
Which is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, remember that you had a sort of shared house in Neasden?
That's
is
right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Going up there, and Carl showing me his chord shapes, and being very specific, I play exactly the right chord shapes. He has big hands. I have small hands. Yeah. And there's this extraordinary massive chords. So actually, I'm afraid to say I lost a note or two when came to the actual show.
Like playing Liszt.
But I mean, that came back because I was signed to a publishing deal by Tom Fenner, who was then at that point an A&R man at ATV Music. And then through that, I did the old Gristle test. And also through that, the guy I was making demos with, Jamie Lane, produced Clock Comes Down the Stairs, which a lot of people think very fondly of as one of the great Mike Robinson albums. He also produced your last album as well.
Yeah, 39 Minutes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Jasper, having to learn... I mean, those songs were tricky songs to learn. So at the time, I had basically wanted to become... I didn't want to become, you know, recognised as a great, great guitar player. And I wasn't traditionally a kind of a guitar player. Like, you know, as in Ireland, they play, can you play fast? I can. Can you play high? Playing fast, then you're good. I wasn't that. I was very much, I don't know, I had this hybrid of using my fingers and chords and because I had to actually, because we didn't have a bass player for a while, I had to play bass and guitar at the same time, effectively. So basically, jumping back into the muscle memory was really, really tricky.
Yeah, yeah.
And then once I was in there, it was really incredible because two things happened. First of all, I was astonished that, you know, I could remember all this stuff, number one. And number two, I was going, this is a really good part. Who wrote this? This is a good idea. Who wrote this? You know, because it feels like you're playing somebody else's music. So that was really, really extraordinary. And it was marvelous.
Yeah. Did you re-influence yourself?
I did actually kind of understand how unique some of the early stuff was, especially things like there was a record called We Hate You South African Bastards.
Which is no longer a title.
No.
You go on Spotify.
That was basically a compilation of
singles.
That's right.
And one of the bits of music on that was this extraordinary bit of music that we recorded in the west of Ireland, in Coolay, in a house belonging to the greatest Irish contemporary composer, Sean O'Riordan. And it was bizarre music, like very small, strange little tunes. I mean, the closest, and I would have said would have been the music to the Magic Roundabout, I would have said. You know, I mean, it was really, what the hell were we doing? I had no idea. And so, like, revisiting that, it was just like, my God, that was inspired to actually do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, because the music that was around us was still pretty angry.
And you yourselves were capable of this degree of, I mean,
oh, totally, yeah.
Songs like 4-6-4 was a roar from the stage, wasn't it?
Well, the thing is, the strange thing is that even though, you know, we didn't have a great relationship with the music press because they thought we were they didn't understand us. They thought we were a little bit, I don't understand you. But we were, musically, we loved, like, obviously the pop group and the Four, but we loved the Birthday Party. They were very, very important to us because they were genuine. Where is this coming from? Where the hell is this coming from? That was really important to us. Go Between is very important to us. Mm. And then in the UK, things like The Associates, you know, they were... And so there, you can see that there's this group of outsiders, you know, who were sort of... you know, we're not talking about The Clash or The Pistols or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm. We're talking about all these kind of outsiders.
And then you've got people like who you already liked, like Skritti Politti, suddenly changing themselves, coming out with The Sweetest Girl, which was the most un-Skritti Politti thing you could sort of imagine.
Yeah.
And I loved, which I adored.
I think that was just
It was a very interesting... It was an interesting time. This is what you're talking about, like 81, 82, 83. Yeah. Really interesting time for what loosely one could call pop music or something.
Yeah.
So many interesting things were going on.
Yeah.
When Micro Disney did split up, there's a sort of consensus that, you know, you went in these two different directions.
Sure.
Mm. And that people have this idea that, you know, when you started making your own music and then the first official, like, High Llama's album, that was sort of what had always been there waiting to come out.
Yeah,
I mean, is that... But then in interviews you said, yeah, but Carl also, you know, could write beautiful melodies. It wasn't like I was sort of the melody guy and he was like the angry front man. That's not fair. But nonetheless, there was all this stuff kind of under the surface that then did start to come out in your music.
Yeah, Cahill was a prodigious melodic writer and really, you know, was very uncompromising with chords as well. I mean, he would really crunch the chords as well. He was, you know, he listened to so much music. So this idea that, you know, Cahill was like the kind of... was in the furnace and I was in the
ivory tower.
It's just crazy. I think the first thing that I really, really tried to do when I left, the weird thing, Alex Chilton was very important to me.
Yeah,
I was a massive Alex fan, and this idea of, you know, being the competent sort of soul writer and embodying a little bit of Americana and a little bit of fascination with oddness, which Alex Chilton always had, I felt really comfortable with that. And so, but I didn't have a voice, literally didn't have a voice, and I didn't have a harmonic voice, and I didn't have a lyrical voice. All I had was you were the guy in Micro Disney, and you were kind of the musical guy, and you're quite a good little guitar player, aren't you?
Yeah.
And that really wasn't me. I mean, there was so, you know, it was so much. I mean, basically what I loved was writing songs and listening to how songs were put together.
Yeah.
And so I was really interested in kind of Alex's solo albums. I was massively interested in the first couple of band records. And again, I want to reiterate, we're talking in 1989. That isn't hip at the time, is it?
No.
It's just so unhip. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in even Jim Clark and, you know, those records. Really, really, really important. And so eventually that sort of kind of came out in this sort of strange little, I would say power, a little kind of little power pop records, you know. Mm. So when I started, I was in again in the studio with Mark.
Yes.
Again. So so at this stage, I mean, Mark is very important in this stage because, first of all, he introduced us to Jamie. So we made The Clock Comes Downstairs and 39 Minutes.
Yeah.
The other thing is that through Jamie and Mark, we both started listening to a lot of soul music.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were massively into, we were suddenly into Bobby Womack, big time. So Bobby Womack was really, really, really important to us. And in fact, 39 Minutes, which is kind of our most rock record, when we did the demos for that, they were like, like Bobby Womack
songs. Right, okay.
And we had an 808 cracking away.
Right.
And we wanted to keep the 808 cracking away. And we had little kind of R&B guitar riffs going on. And the record company just said, you're a rock and roll band.
Yes, you do.
You know?
Yes.
You don't do that. You're a rock and roll band.
Yes.
But, you know, getting into Micro Disney, we're in the studio and we're making these songs that are a little bit like the band, you know, Birdie Sing.
Yeah, yeah, no. I mean, well, first of all, doing stuff just by yourself with me in my flat in Bow, 14th floor of what turns out to be Grime Central, Dizzy Rascals running around on each of 10. And things like Edge of the Sun and those songs. I remember one memorable evening, we watched England play West Germany in Italia 90.
Yeah.
And my cat was savaging you. And then it was taking that into the studio with the first version of High Llamas, which was Tom and John Fell.
Mm.
Who's the
Anita?
Anita, Bissau, that's right. Yeah.
A real Californian.
Yeah. Santa Barbara girl.
Yeah.
And I learned in a hurry that I wasn't a record producer.
But it was. But we had this shared thing where we're talking the early 90s, and you know, Seattle's about to explode. Yeah. Soundgarden, Nirvana in the UK.
Yeah.
It's the whole Bullingate scene. You have all these, and you know, and we're still. You're still, you know, everybody's in that room and I'm still in this room.
Yeah.
You know? You're in the kitchen at parties.
Absolutely. But guess what? Those sessions, I think, actually give rise to little bits of Gideon Gay, which is the next idea. And I like Checking In, Checking Out. I think kind of belongs to that kind of, you know, slight rock and roll thing.
Sure.
Even though the rest of Gideon Gay
isn't like that. Sort of the Steely Dan song for me on that record.
The stuff that I did with Sean ended up on a kind of a compilation album called Santa Barbara. Is it? That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, given the fact I engineered it, it sounds quite good. It sounds all right.
No false humility.
But I was on my way out of the music business at that point.
Yeah, you were. Yeah, I have to say a funny story.
Yes, we welcome funny stories.
There was one point. Pringle. There was one point when Mark was massively frustrated by me. Because I wasn't a nice guy in the studio sometimes. I was pretty, I don't think I was. And I do remember one very late, one in the morning, and we're in Hackney.
Yeah.
And you're lying on the couch, and I'm just going, and then we do this, and we do that. And you're lying on the couch, and you've got your fingers in your eyes, and you're going, diminishing returns, diminishing returns, diminishing returns.
Oh, God.
Fantastic. And it's just like, very funny.
So, for obvious reasons, the High Llamas are like featured artists on the homepage this week, and we've added three or four pieces, one of which is from 1992 when the Santa Barbara Apricots album came out, and it's Stuart McConey talking to you in the issue that came out 22nd of February of that year. And it's just a great quote, which I think really sort of ties in with, you know, this idea of what the High Llamas were going to become or were becoming. In pop music, a lot of it was said and done between 1966 and 1972. This is you, obviously, okay, speaking. That time we call the 60s actually lasted till the early 70s. It's only now that we're really understanding what went on then. We went from a Hard Day's Night to people dabbling in jazz and avant-garde in just 6 years. And a lot of today's bands seem to be attracted by that period, which is more interesting than having a whole generation influenced by Echo and the Bunnymen. I love that, so I just
and it's
had to read that.
It's absolutely true. The one thing that went with you is harmonies becoming really important to you.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the frustrations of the way of working with you is that you had a very good ear and you were really, but it was, you know, I heard you in the studio piling up harmonies with the rest of the band, and which kind of takes us on to the Beach Boys, because there is a kind of clear line there.
Yeah, I came in with Gideon Gay. For whatever reason, I was sent a cassette tape of Gideon Gay. And I didn't even know who the hell it was. I mean, and for some reason, typically, you know, I put it on without knowing anything about it, which is given the amount of stuff he was sort of receiving, I just put it on and I was just like instantly transfixed and transported into the past in this way that, I mean, because I reviewed Hawaii for Mojo and I said something like, kind of, listening to Gideon Gay was like someone stumbling on a kind of a sort of lost treasure chest of Brian Wilson demos recorded in Shoreditch.
Yeah.
You know, and but it was just so, I just loved it. I still love that album so much. And so just tell us, because that's 2 years after you're talking to Stuart McConey.
Yeah, okay. So the thing that happens, I can say this quite quickly. I meet Tim Gain from Stereolab. Tim is very, very important because Tim has created Stereolab. Stereolab are effectively an art rock group. Tim's idea is, first of all, it's all about ideas and people. And so if you've got people who aren't great players, if they're the right people and the ideas are good, everything will work.
Yeah.
I had come out of, you know, 10 years in British pop music where I've been in expensive studios and really learned how to kind of, you know, make shiny pop.
Yes.
And then suddenly I was introduced to this guy and said, will you please be the keyboard player in this band? And, you know, here's a broken Vox organ and it's a great sound and I'm saying, well, is this right? It's whatever you feel, Sean. It's just the vibe. And then being in rehearsal studios and then being on a record called Space Age Bachelor Pad Music, where I actually had a big, big input. And this kind of, wow, these people make records really quickly. And I would have done that again, but they're not doing that again. And actually, it sounds fine. And, well, what do you think, Sean? Well, maybe this.
Diminishing returns.
And it was like,
for a bite.
It was like, wow, this is so refreshing. I'm not kind of, you know, we this is a really interesting way to make music. And I took that away and Gideon Gay basically presented itself. And so rather than sort of kind of being obsessing about being, you know, you've been in this long enough, you're a professional. Yeah, I just thought, no, it's all about ideas. And so suddenly the ideas that I wanted to get down jumped up at me. And those ideas were, I wanted to capture the essence of what was great about the early Beach Boys or the experimental Beach Boys. What was great about things like, you know, Van Dyke Park's Song Cycle. What was great about even Gene Clark's The LA Record, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
No Other, is it?
Yeah, no Other. Yeah. No, there was one, No Other, and then the thing called The LA Sessions. The LA Sessions, yeah. And then even sort of odd little things like Fred Neil, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted the texture to be kind of, so it was a dry record. There wasn't much reverb.
No. which I loved about it.
Yeah, it was a dry record, and I was working with Charlie Francis. Big shout to Charlie Francis in Cardiff now. Amazing guy, amazing producer. Went on to work with REM. Great guy. So Charlie and myself and the various members of the High Lamas in and out, but Charlie and myself there for like 3 days solid, just working 24 hours. And I'd say, and then we do this, and then we do that. And Charlie would go, that's ridiculous, Sean. And I'd say, no, it will work. And sort of the driest vox, borrowed a vox, the driest vox. Okay, Charlie, we're going to record up the upright piano and we're going to record it. And like, this is twice. And he goes, you don't need to record it twice. He says, you do, because when you record it twice, you have variations in the rhythm. And I'm going to do it pretty tight, but not that tight. And then the harmonies, I would, rather than having the sort of classic sort of West Coast harmonies, I would have these dry harmonies, because I was, you know, if you listen to Smiley Smile, or you listen to the great Beach Boys record where they basically kind of found the Smile tapes and tried to make finish the record while Brian was sleeping upstairs. You know, they're dry,
very dry,
and you can hear the nuance of everybody's voice. Go, that's Carl, that's Dennis, whatever. Yes. So I was trying to do that. Mm-hmm. And then once we had these, we didn't have enough music. And I said, it doesn't matter we haven't got enough music, because we're just going to turn the tape upside down. And we're just going to basically listen to it backwards. And whatever we hear backwards, if it's good, we're going to use it, and we're going to create another song like that, you know? And which is what we did. Mm. And then I said, okay, now we haven't got any more studio time, so we're going to go to your flat with a Shruti box and a Moog and a drum machine. I'm just going to record lots of little... Because the other thing I was big into Holgerzuke at the time.
Right.
Now, and Holger's experimental records, you know, his tape manipulation records, loved all that. Mm. And I said, I wanted to... and I would say to Charlie, this is the Holgerzuke bit. And we just recorded maybe 2 days of funny little kind of sections. And then we listened to that and just what worked. And the record was put together as a theme. So it was probably only 5 recorded songs, 3 upside down songs, and then 7 pieces of experimentation. And the whole thing just basically crossfaded from one thing to another. Again, it's something that is, you know, the idea of, by the way, that was about to emerge in hip hop big time,
right?
You know?
Yes.
You know, people like Dilla would be doing things like that big time, you know?
Yeah.
So it was this kind of, I think people described it as kind of West Coast Gothic and all sorts of things, you know? But it was, because it was just so different, it was bound to make a mark.
And the lyrics, too, were so extraordinary. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, I got the references, but, you know, the goat looks on. Mm. I mean, these and I subsequently read you talking about how it had a lot to do with, like, Dulwich Hamlets and where you were living around there.
Yeah,
so there was this whole little concept going on.
Gideon Gay, the actual song Gideon Gay, is actually, in these... Shaking Towers, head down, skybound. That's a lift. Gideon Gay is about Tim and Letitia from Stereolab and myself being invited by Carlton Television, right, into Carlton Towers. Remember Carlton?
Carlton on Sloane Street.
No, they were
where the TV. Yeah,
they took over. They were basically. They got the ITV contract.
Yeah.
And they lasted. ITV was Carlton in the UK for about 3 years.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, we're going to be completely new. And all our idents are going to be really new. And we want you to do the idents. And so we were brought in to write the Carlton idents. And I wrote a lot of them with Tim. And none of them ended up being used, of course. There were a couple of executives. You did what? You what? 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 Are you mad? But that is actually about being invited into Carlton Tower.
Why not write about stuff? Yeah. I love that. I love it.
Head down, skybound, corridor, phone, tube, barely stand.
I do have to ask, is slip in a question about Arthur Lee, because we're talking about kind of, you know, LA cult heroes, and you played one show at the Garage with Arthur Lee.
And one show at the Albert Hall with Arthur.
At the Albert Hall. So how did that come about? I mean, I know I saw you play with Van Dyke Parks at the QE Hall some years after that, but I never really found out how you got to play behind Arthur.
Well, what happened was Gideon Gay was effectively bootlegged in the USA by a guy in Chicago who was Arthur Lee's manager. So he loved Gideon Gay, but it wasn't licensed to him, but he thought it was, and he just started selling it.
It's a good defence, isn't it? I thought it was.
So this guy sent me a letter saying, Arthur Lee's coming to the UK. I've never heard anybody who could sort of back Arthur, but I think you guys could. Mm. Would you do it? And I just went, wow. And I got a letter, you know, it's not a phone call, letter. And I went, wow, yeah. And so I just, rather than thinking about it, I went, yes, of course. and it was effectively the first two records, you know. Yeah. So Orange Skies and More Again, Alone Again, All. And we basically put together a band, which was the High Llamas, plus my flatmate called Liz Martin, who was a flautist.
Because Jay Cantrelli was the flautist.
Don't know.
You need a flautist.
You need a flautist.
Yes.
And a three-piece string section. We just went in and we rehearsed and we got it down big time.
Wow.
And one day Arthur turns up in London. My mate, Neil Robson, who's in Cornwall now, who was basically a painter decorator at the time, said, can you go and pick up Arthur Lee from that Cumberland Hotel? And bring him down to Peckham, to New Cross, where we're rehearsing. And he said, yeah. So he had an escort van. He had a white escort van full of paint, right? And so he goes up to the Cumberland Hotel, and Arthur comes down, just in, jet-lagged, you know, glasses.
One lens blue and one lens red. No.
He walks out and walks over to a limousine. There's a limousine outside, of course, because it's
the wrong car.
And he walks over and stands beside it with a filmmaker who's just there the whole time. And Neil says, no, sorry, it's the
one with the paints.
It's the one that looks like I'm about to kidnap you and hold you hostage.
He is huge. The man's huge. And so he can barely... So he gets in the front seat and his legs are all doubled up and everything. We bring him down to New Cross and he comes out and we're in a basement rehearsal room. We'd rehearsed the morning and Arthur Lee walks down into the basement. We're there, guitar, organ, drums, bass, three-piece strings.
Flute.
And he looks around and he goes, okay, Orange Skies, hit it. And we just did it and it was incredible. And we did the whole set. And he said, we're good. This love is the best. We're the best. We're good.
Wow.
And then he said, let's go to the pub. And so we went to the pub.
Which pub?
The pub is no longer... Oh. It's across the road from the... what was the music room back then? The old music room, not the new one. And we drank Guinness. And we all sat around. And the pub was empty, apart from three incredibly sort of... quite posh middle-class girls and a band and a very tall guy from LA with a wig.
With a wig, yes.
And drinking Guinness. And
did he like Guinness?
Yeah, he liked it.
Had he drunk Guinness before?
I think he might have. And he spoke about he spoke a lot about knowing Jimi Hendrix, you know?
Yeah.
And that was just incredible. Yeah. And then when we went back and he said, we need to rehearse... Arthur, we need to do it again. He goes, okay, let's do it again. And so when we went back, he said, what's the deal with the gig? And I said, well, it's the Meanfield are promoting it, they're really good, whatever. And he goes, I want 50% of the money up front.
And, right.
And I said, don't think it happens, but...
That works. Have a word with Vince Power.
Yeah. Yes. And so I did, literally... put him on to Vince Powell. I literally said, look, I took him up. And it's really funny. I took him up and there was... And it was no mobile phones. So I knocked him. Do you have a telephone? Arthur Lee wants to call. And then this I know, because it was Gordon who ran it, and his kids were small at the time. They're all running around, utterly on the phone to Vince Bell, saying, can I have 50% of the fee up front? It's just mad, isn't
it? Yeah.
Just crazy stuff.
It's sort of like, you know, it's the sort of Chuck Berry school of how to operate
in America. And the actual show, when we turn up at the garage and we sound check, and everything goes well, and Arthur Lee disappears. And nobody can find him, so it's showtime, okay? The High Lamas support, right? An incredible thing happens. Every A&R man is in London because of two things. They've heard the High Lamas are a band to watch, and Arthur Lee's playing. So you've just got this whole array of A&R people.
Yeah.
So
waiting for Arthur to reappear.
Yeah. We play an amazing set, and the next day, literally within the next week, we've got massive offers from everybody, from Warner Brothers, from Almo, from Sony, everybody's, you know.
Kind of. Yes.
Arthur Lee, so it's time for us to play, and we have to go and find Arthur Lee. So literally five people are sent down Holloway Road to find Arthur Lee, and he's eventually found in a bar.
Drinking Guinness,
with a bunch of guys from the west of Ireland playing pool, okay? And then they bring him back, put him on stage, and go, let's do it, and we do it, and it's incredible. Massively, just mad.
That's extraordinary.
It's an amazing
it
story.
Sounds like a pretty typical Arthur Lee story, but I'm glad it's part of the High Lamas story too. Yeah, said it's alright, I won't forget all the times I've waited patiently for you. If we jump forward to like Hawaii, which I again absolutely love, so many incredible things. I mean, it's very, very long. There's about how many? 29 songs
on
it.
Like a
double album, really, or even triple album. It's an amazing piece of work. As a result of that, Bruce Johnston, I believe, hears it.
Yeah.
Which I think is so interesting because Bruce Johnston was the real crusader for Pat Sounds, wasn't he?
Yeah.
When he came over to London in 66. And he hears it and he tells the others about this guy Sean O'Hagan. So, what's your memory of that?
So what happens is we're signed to Sony by Jeremy Pierce. Jeremy Pierce is a really important A&R guy in London at the time because he has LRD, and LRD has Creation. Creation is the biggest story in town.
Right.
Oasis are breaking. He has Suede, Oasis, and Jeremy is like the man. So he signs. We're signed, and the head of Sony also hears Checking In, Checking Out on the radio. Conroy, pulls his car over and says, gets on, and I think he did have a mobile phone, sign this band immediately. And so it's everything's rolling. It's just like, you know, it's just incredible. We're signed to Sony. And we make Hawaii. And, of course, Sony think they're going to get Checking In, Checking Out 11 times.
Yes.
And instead they get Hawaii, you know, which is just like kind of just a right left field, completely left field. Hawaii has obviously all the hallmarks of all sorts of things, but obviously the Beach Boys kind of experimental era is very much there. Bruce gets to hear it and has a relationship with Richard Branson, who is starting V2 Records. He's getting back into the music industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does two things. He starts V2 Records. He poaches Jeremy Pierce away from LRD and basically says, I can't sign the Stones, I can't sign the Beatles, but if I can sign the Beach Boys to my new label, it'll be there. He has this relationship with Bruce. Bruce says, you've got this guy, you've got this kid, you know, and if we put this kid with the Beach Boys, this can all happen. And so suddenly I'm sent over on a mission to sign the Beach Boys, to talk to the Beach Boys, to bring them back with Brian to basically create the first artistic Beach Boys record in 25 years. And I'm sent. And my first trip is to Columbus, Ohio, to meet the Beach Boys. Before I don't meet Brian first. I meet the Beach Boys.
Because they're presumably touring without Brian.
They're playing in a football stadium. Post match entertainment. Is that right?
Post match entertainment. I think it's Columbus, Ohio. I think a big football game has just happened. I'm picked up at the airport by Bruce Johnson. I'm brought to a very, very expensive restaurant, wined and dined, and then brought to the football stadium. I walk into the changing room of the football stadium and the Beach Boys are all there in their underpants.
Changing as if to play football.
No, as if, no, because they're changing into their stage
costume. Yeah.
And in these places are enormous. There's just huge. You've got in inner roads in these places. You've got sort of a, so you can basically drive, you know, vehicles. Outside there are 9 409 cars, the vintage 409s. Okay, a member of the Beach Boys gets into each one. So the 9 409s drive out onto
the pitch
with. What do you call the showgirls with the balloons?
Oh, the cheerleaders.
Cheerleaders.
Yeah, yeah.
In each car, yeah. And then get on stage. So that's what I'm witnessing. I'm really jet-lagged and I'm just going, so weird. I don't know what's going on. I'm really weirded out. And Carl Wilson's wife is Gina Martin, Dean Martin's daughter.
Right.
Gina Martin comes over and says, this must be very peculiar for you. Oh, I know how weird it is. Just stay with me, okay? Oh, so I did. And then I saw this show, which was very, very good. The live band were incredible. The live band had been basically the Beach Boys live band for quite a while. You know, Al and Bruce were playing really well. Carl was playing well. I think Steve Desper was out front on the sound. I think Jeff Foskett was in the band. It was a fantastic band. And then we go back to a hotel and the Beach Boys, various members of the Beach Boys say, you're over from England to maybe talk to us about a record.
Yeah, yeah.
And Richard Branson, Virgin Records, you know, and all of that. And it all starts emerging and I'm sort of wandering downstairs with the band. And then the next day we're in a zoo somewhere. And it's
fitting.
What is it
really?
With zoos and the Beach Boys?
Zoos are very important in the Beach Boys story.
And it's and there's some kind of, it's a big zoo out, don't know where it is, we flew, and everybody's barbecuing. So the audience, it's like kind of both South Africa, basically. Everybody's in shorts, shirts, and barbecuing. Very white.
Very white.
Yeah.
Well, that's...
So I'm with these guys, and so it's daylight and it's the afternoon, and I'm saying, yeah, so I think the idea is that you're going to make are you going to write? Al's saying, are you going to write? Carl's saying, maybe you should write. And they said, have you got any songs? And I did have a song. I had a thing that was on Cotton Bounty. It's called The Painter's Paint, and I was in the middle of making Cotton
it's
Bounty.
It's very Beach Boys, though.
Yeah,
yes.
And I just I played it backstage.
The painters paint all those sad old saints.
And they just said, "This is perfect. This is perfect. This is perfect." And then Bruce was going, "I told you the kid was good. I told you the kid was good." The kid. I was probably 32. And then they said, if you're going to play with us, you're going to produce us, you've got to play with us. So you've got to come on stage. So I had to play.
That night?
Yeah, it was an afternoon. Yeah,
it was an afternoon. Yeah, sure, yeah. Right,
maybe
right,
it was 7
yeah,
o'clock
right,
or something
right,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
So they said, "Can you? What do you want to play?" And I said, "Well, would you play Sail on Sailor?" And they said, "We haven't played that for like so
we
long.
Don't play that.
We don't play that." Yeah, yeah. But they went to the archives, got out the song sheets, and they rehearsed it.
Oh, wow.
Right? And they did
it. Your request. That is fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And we also did I Can Hear Music. Yeah.
Right.
And I was next to Carl. Unfortunately, they gave me a guitar with a whammy bar, which I hate. Because if you're not used to whammy bars, your guitar's out of tune the whole time. You know? unless you know whammy bars. That's horrible. And so that was extraordinary.
And deep commotion often frightened, unenlightened. Sail on, sail on, sail on.
And then I think the next day I had a big meeting, and it was a big at the Hyatt Hotel somewhere, and it was a massive big room cordoned off, huge table. And the Beach Boys were all going to arrive, and the meeting would be, envisaging what we were going to do. Now, the beginning of the meeting was Carl just came down before the rest of them and sat with me, and he was great. And Carl was such a sweet guy, and he said, everybody will have an idea. Don't listen to anybody.
Except me. No.
He says, don't let anybody write lyrics. He says, the lyrics, we don't write great lyrics. Or don't let Brian write the lyrics. Just, you know. But there'll be so many ideas going across the table. Just, you know. And he said, whatever it was that we knew, whatever we knew back then that created those sounds, whatever it is, we don't know what it is anymore. And so we need people. We need people. So they all arrive, Al, Carl, Bruce, everybody arrives. And you've got these people who are like, they're one of the most defining acts of the 20th century. And you're sitting there and you're pep talk, giving them a pep talk. I mean, it's just crazy. It's just ridiculous. And I felt really stupid and embarrassed. But I said, my idea is this. Let's go and make Sunflower again. And everybody thought, that's a great idea.
Okay.
And they said, why Sunflower? I said, because you all wrote. Everybody wrote on Sunflower. Everybody wrote.
Yes.
Everybody had two songs. And they went,
the kid's
right. And so they thought that was a great idea.
Right.
And so that was the outcome. So the next stage was I had to meet Brian and convince Brian. And then the next stage was I had to go to the lawyers, convince the lawyers. So then I was back. And then I was back with the Beach Boys. And then I was back in LA with Brian. And it went on and on. And I eventually jumped out because I wasn't convinced that the people at... We have to use American language. Brian's people were completely on board with the Beach Boys people.
Right.
That's how they speak about it in America.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes,
and I wasn't sure that there was an understanding. Melinda was really unsure about it. I think she was protecting Brian big time. Melinda was very good. Melinda, their marriage was quite young at that stage. Melinda had brought Brian happiness. Brian hadn't had happiness for a long time. He'd been through so many iterations of how to be an adult. Mm. And then finally he was with this woman he was very much in love with and who treated him like an adult, and he was happy. So she was protecting him, and I stand by that. And and so I just said, look, I'm never going to finish Cold and Bouncy if this carries on, because I think I went on about four trips.
Yeah, yeah.
There's one or two stories which I will tell at another time when if I'm still alive. And I'm so careful about what I say.
Yeah.
I take it the one does involve, yes, but we'll leave that for another time.
So I think this is a good moment to
talk about the Beach Boys.
Point out that this episode coincides with the imminent publication of The Beach Boys by The Beach Boys, which is a great big Genesis Publications book of photographs coming out next week. So it's a good enough reason to talk about them. But we have had this audio interview, have we not, Mark? For some years we've had, and this is the perfect time for us to add it to Rock's Back Pages. Yes, Mark, tell us about it.
Absolutely. It's in a sort of bar or something, because there's a cocktail pianist and a guitar player.
Maybe it's a hotel bar or something like that. Vancouver.
Mike Quigley. This is Mike Quigley, isn't it? He interviews them all in turn. First of all, Al Jardine.
Do you want to say what year it is?
Sorry. It's 15th of January 1969.
Right. Which is quite extraordinary. Yeah, yeah. We don't have many audio interviews from the 60s. And this is
it is quite hard to hear what they're saying in times, because there's a lot of background. So Al talks about vocal arrangements in the studio, about changing their image. Listen to the first clip, which is, you know, the question is, you know, are the Beach Boys camp or underground?
I was wondering, do you think that the group has a potential of sort of becoming rather camped? You know, I mean, people are much look upon you for, you know, the Beach Boys today, but it's a process. You have to wait for several years and then look back, which is what I do now and why I really sort of dig some of your early stuff.
Oh, yeah, of course the Beach Boys would be camped. That's what's really kind of fun. It's funny, we're kind of a... you're probably going to disagree, but... We're kind of a really underground group that's way above ground because of some of the things that we try. You know, most people associate our old big groovy hits with
those things. USA,
yeah, plus good vibration. Yeah. But, we try some really interesting things, you know, besides being outright commercial.
Which album would you recommend to listen to for these, you know, new sonic developments?
No, well, maybe then they were, but now they're just kind of... for a lot of them together, I'd say Smiley Smile, but more than that, I'd say Pet Sounds.
Pet Sounds, yeah, I think that's a really terrific album. You know,
I think that's the best Beach Boy album.
It's really interesting because it describes the actual split you were sort of describing within, you know, within the band. And this is around the time, it was before Holland, wasn't it? But it was...
69, it's just after Friends.
Yeah, yeah, 2020 is about to come
That's
out.
That's right, 2020.
Which they say in the next clip.
Yeah, absolutely. Bruce also talks about the various band members. He sort of knows the history of the band, even though he was quite a recent...
Well, he had been in since 65.
He says four years.
He took over from Glenn Campbell, remember?
Yeah, that's exactly, right. Exactly, yeah.
Then we get Carl Wilson and Mike Love together. I mean, first of all, the first thing is it's very difficult to tell Al Jardine and Bruce Johnston apart because they've got remarably similar speaking voices.
Yes.
Quite high and quite wispy.
Yes.
So then Carl and Mike come along. What are your influences for Freshman, Chuck Berry? They talk about 2020 being about to come up. And they talk about critics reading too much into their songs.
So what's in store for you now after Friends? Have you got another album coming out soon?
Yeah, we have an album called 2020 coming out right now. It'll be out any second. Oh, here it is. No, it'll be out. It'll be out. Like next week.
Let's see.
Will it be out next week, Mark?
Well, I would say that if it isn't by next week, it'll either be out earlier than next week or in the very near future.
Oh, good. But, you know, sometimes.
But not wishing to seem ambiguous, I would give it a date, well, somewhere between whatever it is now and, like, 1st of February.
Yeah, I would say that.
Might take a little suspense out of it.
It'll be out.
Did I hear you say something about the cultural significance?
Believe it or not, I was
trying to read something into this whole thing.
I don't know. Do you think I am?
Probably.
I mean, you don't
consider yourself that serious.
I mean, you know,
consider the all the guys that are listening to you, though.
Oh,
really? I mean, you've been here for 7 years or so, haven't you? We consider ourselves very seriously, but I think that the erstwhile critics get into it a little too much for their own good.
Yeah.
I think they overdo it a little bit, like in finding hidden meanings. Well comes
the
time
for change. The erstwhile, so Mike Love, to use the word erstwhile. I mean, oh, he's such a prick.
Yeah. I'm very glad we've got this. It's quite a tough
You need to listen to it on headphones, really, because it's hard.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is fascinating just hearing these guys talking.
Yeah.
In the year, of course, of like Manson.
On the horizon. I'm slightly sorry that Quigley kind of didn't say what's Dennis up to these days.
Well, yes. So Brian obviously isn't there. And yeah. Dennis is probably out
being a swordsman in Los Angeles with Terry Melcher. It's interesting, one of the earliest things, first things you said when we were talking about your background and all that was the way the Beach Boys were thought of. And they are right at that moment when they're kind of dismissed as an old pop band.
They're literally on the cabaret circuit at this stage. They literally cannot get booked, you know. It's bizarre. And I think the big change happens for them when they get signed to Warner Brothers, don't they? So I think what happens is...
Well, they're given their own label, aren't they? The Brother label, which David Anderley runs.
So the Brothers label is... Isn't there a connection with Reprise?
Yes. Yeah. Mo Austin gives them their own label.
And so Reprise obviously has the... And Reprise is started by Sinatra, yeah?
Correct.
And Mo Austin is a very different sort of A&R person.
So the Capitol guys.
Yeah. He's a real experimental... He's a hippie, he's an experimentalist... And I did research this, and I actually did a review. I reviewed, you know, there was a release about four years ago of Smiley Smile, Surf's Up, Sessions, and I did reviewed it for The Wire, and I did a load of research.
Oh, wow.
I should have read that again. And
we've probably got it next door. Yeah. You quickly go and mug up on it.
Yeah. And I think Mo Austin is invited to the studio. And the studio is the studio where Brian's asleep upstairs and the guys are downstairs. And literally, Brian is asleep upstairs and listening to kind of like Smiley Smile being made. And then when he hears something that's not right, he literally comes down in his dressing gown and just says, whatever. And by the way, what happens is I think Al pulls out the Smile tapes. The Smile tapes are literally hidden away in the archives, and he pulls them out and they basically start playing them again and said, you know, this stuff's really great, isn't it? And that's why, like, Surf's Up ends up on Surf's Up with the producer. So the producer Surf's Up is really the guy's producing it, right, as far as Brian, I know. I think it's Brian. I think it's basically Brian's, you know, initial vocal and guitar and piano track, and the rest of the guys kicking in. And Jack Riley's brought to the house.
Jack Riley.
And he...
The voice of A Day in the Life of a Tree.
Yeah. And he's brought to the house, and I think he maybe brings in Mo Austin, and they basically say, this is incredible.
Yeah.
What the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
And they realise something really special is happening.
Yeah.
And so suddenly they get this fantastic... They get the Brothers record at Warner's.
Well, I mean, just... If we go back to 2020, it's such a fascinating record, because it's got, like, cheesy Beach Boys stuff on it. It's got Do It Again, which is a kind of nostalgic throwback to their surf days. But it finishes with two of the Smile tracks, Our Prayer and the extraordinary Cabin Essence, which I think is one of the very great things that Brian and Van Dyke did together.
Without a doubt.
But it, and also, of course, it has the Charles Manson song on it. Never Learn Not to Love, which of course started Life Has Ceased to Exist.
That's right.
So it's such a revisiting it for this episode. I was just struck by how kind of schizophrenic it is.
It is schizophrenic.
Is Manson's name taken off the credits?
Of course,
Did that have anything to do with his mood in the sort of the early part of 1969?
With whose mood? With
Manson's mood.
Manson's mood. That is certainly part of why he became so angry towards the music.
Yes, but the question is, did it also poison his things generally?
There is a strong argument that he was very angry towards Terry Melcher in particular, which is why he went to the Melcher house, thinking that Melcher was there. Because he wasn't.
So, I mean, this is... So, really, the point here is what Mark was referring to. And he said, the first thing I said was that the Beach Boys, when I was a kid, were like an embarrassment.
Yeah.
And so...
Corny. Corny.
Corny.
Yeah.
And the actual reality is that they are pretty crazed guys living a pretty unusual lifestyle in LA, and nobody knows about
mad this. As a bag of badgers,
absolutely. and literally the Beach Boys, you know for all the UFO club and Floyd and everything like that, they had nothing on these guys were, you know. And you know, and the other thing is, in LA, everybody's, you know, there were guns around and, anyway. You know,
I mean, there's London madness and then there's Hollywood madness.
Yeah.
And that's madness squared, so, isn't it?
And I think one of the things that actually happens in the 90s when we all start talking about, you know, Brian and the Beach Boys, and you know, you're part of the story, Barney, because you're one of the first people who basically makes a reference back to the Nick Kent article. I guess I'm part of the story. There aren't many people in LA who are part of the story at this stage. It's still very underground in LA. But
it's the Wonderments guys, isn't it?
This is what I'm about to say.
The sort of indie boy fans of the great experimental Beach Boys.
So what happens is, I swear to God, this actually happens. The High Llamas are in Amoeba Bookstore playing a show in the afternoon.
This is on Sunset.
In 97, I think.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of kids come out for that. And this is Darius and Probin have told me this. He said that's when a lot of people came together and discovered each other. It's like everybody came out of the woods and said, oh, you're a Beach Boys fan. You're a Beach Boys fan. And they all came because they like the High Llamas. The Beach Boys fans all came out and met. And that's effectively when the whole Wonderments thing kicked off.
Right. Wow. Right. Yeah. That's fantastic. That's pretty fast.
Very cool.
Because they became a really superb backing band for Brian.
I mean, the Smile gigs. I didn't see the Pat Sounds gigs at the Royal Festival, but I saw the Smile gigs, and they were just...
I only saw the televising various things. And I know his voice isn't quite what it is. He can't get up as high as he used to. But you can tell that he feels really secure with these people around him playing, and that's what he needs.
That's what he needed, yeah.
Shall we bring your story, up to date?
Yes.
And just talk about Hey Panda?
Yeah, I'd love to, yeah.
The wonderful new High Llamas record, which comes out tomorrow as we're sitting here on Thursday, will have been out a few days by the time the episode goes live. So we've been listening to it. It's an extraordinary kind of... it's an evolution of the High Llamas. It's 8 years since the last album.
Here come the Rattling Trees.
There's been a lot of albums you've done, very different things, but this is really quite a striking departure from some of the templates, isn't it? So tell us about the germination of this record.
Okay, so it really goes back to the thing I said a long time ago. You know, as a kid, I'd always listened to soul music, what we called then, what became known as R&B, whatever, and basically because Black music basically has great arrangements and great tunes.
Yeah.
You know, always. And, I mean, even my favourite parts of Todd is when he's covering, you know, the great Philly songs.
Yeah.
You know? Now, in my opinion, something great happened, you know, over the last 35, 40 years. And that was... You know, after, you know, after our initial introduction to hip-hop in the 80s, the move towards a really sort of experimental musicality in hip-hop via, you know, Questlove and Jay Dilla throughout the 90s, and then into the 2000s, and then eventually into, you know, Erica Farrell, all those people bringing incredible musicality. I'd say back into Black music, you know, after a time when, fascinating as Detroit House was, you know, this suddenly there was a kind of a writing urgency in R&B again. And over the last maybe 10 years, there's a new hybrid, and it's a kind of I call it a hybrid between bedroom hip hop and dream pop, and there's this beautiful mixture, and popularized by people like Lil Yachty, Steve Lacy, Kajabone. These are, you know, they're No Name, Pivot Gang. These guys, they're making incredibly unusual, musical, stunning records. Now, we're all people of a certain age, apart from Jasper.
Jasper's also of a certain age.
Yeah.
It's just
a different age.
We have a tendency to sign... maybe not us, but certain people sometimes have a tendency to feel as though they own the history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Own, you know? And so, and you might say, like, for instance, that awful time when... Somebody, I can't remember, said was 1971 the greatest year ever? And Jan, the guy from Rolling Stone, went out, said women never made classic records. They were made by men like Dylan.
Yeah, Stevie and women Wonder, were philosophers.
All Black people.
Yeah. All Black people, yes.
So you have this kind of ridiculous, when's the classic, when's the golden age? And my argument is while you're speaking about that, you might be missing the golden age.
Yes, exactly.
Of course.
We could just be in the golden age now.
Yes.
And if you look at someone like Tyler, the Creator, he's
who's a fan of yours.
What a guy. I mean... Just have a look at the... I mean, he's a great filmmaker. He's got his brand, which is Le Fleuve.
Yeah.
If you want to hear what Tyler's up to, just basically go and... on and check out his brand, because his very latest music is always there. Mm-hmm. And it is just extraordinary. It's like Michel Legrand, you know, with Beats. It's just fantastic, you know.
Yeah, why not?
And, you know, we are going through a great spot. Even the kids who play jazz now, they play jazz and have an electronic or a hip-hop profile.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not jazzers. They're jazzers. Back in the 80s, you know, like when the jazz guys were very separate.
Yes.
No, we're not interested, you know. Mm. The guys who play jazz now are interested. All you have to do is go on and watch Tiny Desk on NPR and just watch Tanker and the Bangers, Thundercat.
I love Tanker and the Bangers, yeah.
The Tyler sessions, the Anderson .Paak sessions.
That's one of my very favourite sessions.
Yeah,
that is such a great session.
Unbelievable. And you know something? Say when I did 8 years ago when I was doing Hig on the Rattling Trees, which is basically stage show. And the reason why I wrote that and did that is because I literally said there's no point in making records anymore. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to listen. So I may as well do something different. So I thought I'd write stage and music. And I thought that it really wasn't like, no, I had nothing to say and nobody was listening. And then basically once your kids grow up and your house is full of, you know, the Solange record, John Carroll Kirby, Eddie Chacon, those people, I just think, I love this. And whereas before, I'd say, I cannot occupy that world. I don't have the voice. I don't have the tools. Mm. I just thought, maybe I do. Uh-huh. I met Ben Garrett from Friars. Friars is this UK R&B pop outfit. He's a producer. He brought me in to make his record. And suddenly I was in a studio with people from UK R&B, and I was co-writing, I was writing strings, and I was learning this new language, and I loved it, and I just flipped, and I said, I'm not appropriating. This isn't cultural appropriation. I'm going to make the record.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to make it work. And so, you know, I wanted... We've been talking about the Beach Boys, but I wanted to make a record that was closer to Disclosure and Khalid's Can We Just Talk, you know, which was just... Because I just thought that... Or, you know, I mean, it's WizKid's Essence or something like that, you know. And I found I could do it, and I just went home and just started doing it.
Yeah.
And I just put the auto-tune on, and I basically just started, whereas before I would have esoteric small tapping snares.
Sure.
Yeah. I just had, you know,
an
808 just thumping.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this thing of, which you get an awful lot in R&B, a lot of people don't do it anymore, but I love it, the idea of, whereas if you're a kind of, you're supposed to play around the beat, and they just basically hammer the beat, you know. Mm. So if you've got and I said to you, you might actually sort of say, maybe have a bit of tacit or space. Suddenly you say no, and I said to you is da 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 da, then the space.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I mean,
you just basically create different relationships there.
Weep like a woman. Sleep like a baby.
I mean, I find it fascinating listening to it because it's the blackest thing I've ever heard you do. And it's also that you're listening to people who in turn are listening to people like Roger Troutman, Zapp, maybe even Marvin Gaye's Midnight Love, the use of things like the 808, the processed voice, and so on and so forth, that they've been refiltered through a whole new generation of people who you're then filtering, kind of. So it's like, you know, I mean, I just heard that, even though it doesn't sound anything like those records. You know, Zapp, Roger Troutman, someone I've absolutely always adored, because they sound like they're from another planet, those records. They don't sound like they're from a time.
Yeah.
At all. And it's just fabulous. We were listening to it this morning in the office, and it's like, this is really bloody good.
Thank you very much.
I really love hearing you talk about being influenced by people like No Name and Anderson .Paak and Tyler the Creator, and just these people that I absolutely adore and whose music I love sonically. And it's really interesting to hear your sonics be influenced by those sonics? And in particular, there's one, I don't know if you know Jake Sherman.
No, I don't.
Particularly, actually, the vocal delivery and the vocoder use reminds me of some of the stuff he does. He's worked with guys like Chance. Mm. And then also James Blake was another name that I sort of felt...
Blake is incredible. You know, and James Blake, I mean, and we've got a British side. I mean, obviously James Blake is in LA, but he's very British. Yeah, and then his work with Mount Kimby is just fantastic.
Yes.
Now, when I talked about this kind of this hybrid of sort of dream pop, indie and in hip-hop, I think Mount Kimby are sort of, you know... are purveyors of that. Mm. They started off on Fruity Loops with Beats, but they've basically sort of moved into guitars. Mm-hmm. So their new record sounds like Wire, you know? But it sounds like Wire after you've come from Beats. It's like Wire with Lil Yachty involved, or you know, it's
Wire really, featuring Lil Yachty.
It's incredible. Really, really amazing. Yeah. So there is there's a very big British profile here as well.
But I mean, you know, also, you know, given having said all of that, there's you right bang in the centre of it, your voice and the way you use your voice.
Yeah, and Ray Morris, who sang Sister's Friends, who was so important. And my daughter, Livy.
Yes.
So my daughter, Livy, is on, and she's a big part. She basically, we make playlists together. You know, I do. Have you heard Baird? New LA kid,
possibly.
Oh, just incredible! Just this again. He comes.
You have to do a playlist.
Absolutely.
I haven't had time to write down all these amazing names.
So Livy, she's on the records and makes absolute perfect sense on the records.
Right.
There's also the other thing I brought in. I hope is a little bit of personal shit, which I don't normally have, and a little bit of humour. The humour, there's a song called Fall Off the Mountain, which is basically about the sheep watching walkers. And I've got this thing about walkers feeling pleased about themselves. He says, I'm walking. You know, he says, you're watching the television. You're fat. You know, I'm a geography teacher. I'm walking. And I feel good about myself. You know, I feel good about myself.
Well, geography teachers do walk.
Yeah.
They have to walk.
And then the sheep just think, You don't belong here. You're going to trip over your shoelaces.
Your dog's going to bark at us.
Yeah, your dog's going to, and you're going to fall, and it's going to be horrible. And so it's basically called Fall Off the Mountain, you know. And there's a rap at the end where I can't do it, but if I'm a robot, I can do it. There's a bit of humour, you know. We're standing, you're falling, you're dry stone, dry walling.
That's superb.
Yeah. And it's just like being slightly funny about things. Yoga Go.
I love Yoga Go. And then the Return of the Goat. How many times have goats featured in Llamas? Oh,
they've probably popped up everywhere. Yeah, there's donkeys, dogs, horses, everything.
Llamas.
I think what really comes across is just a sense of freedom that you felt making it.
Yeah,
and that comes across listening to you speak, and it comes across listening to the record. Yeah. And I absolutely love it.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Really fantastic.
Yeah, bless you. Best of luck with that. I mean, are there gigs? Anything like, are you going to be doing any shows?
Yeah, I didn't think I'd do any shows. I remember speaking to Mark about it ages ago, saying, I don't know if I can play this. But, you know, something we had to play 2 weeks ago on the BBC for... And so we put the four piece together and we did it.
Oh, great.
And it works. And we're playing on Rough Trade East on next week, actually. Oh, cool. We're doing four songs. We're being interviewed by Nick Watt from...
we know Nick Watt. Yes. Yeah.
And we're doing four songs. And then definitely in October...
What night is that?
That's a Wednesday night.
Wednesday night. So the day after this goes. Yeah. So according to this episode...
I'm out of town.
You're in the country.
I'm in the country. I'm one of these walkers you're talking about.
No, I love walking.
Mark will have fallen off a mountain.
I love walking. But, you know, when I went to the Dales and with Joe and we went for a walk, I said, look, we're in the Yorkshire Dales. Why are there no brown people? We are on the foothills of Leeds, you know?
Yeah.
And there are no Asian people.
There are walking groups. It's a real thing now.
Yeah. Oh, really?
It is groups of inner city kids going on these walks. It's become a thing.
Well, that's great, because it just the absence of diversity Hills was kind of annoyed me. Maybe I was a little bit angry writing Fall Off the Mountain. And then October, we've got a run of three shows, so we're definitely going to be we're doing shows in October.
Where are they?
So we're playing Trades Club on October the 19th, Birmingham, I'm not sure where, and Otto on the 21st. So what's happened is, like, promoters are getting in touch with us and saying, will you play? And I said, I don't know if we can. And then we've rehearsed and we said, yes, we can.
Yeah,
and
great.
We are.
Great. Oh, that's fantastic. That's
wonderful. Isn't it?
Fall off the mountain, sing by the sea. So springs the water, searching for the sea.
We've really gone over time, haven't we?
Because massively gone.
You've been far too good a guest, Sean. But we are just going to wrap up now with some pieces that we've added to the RBP library. Do jump in if anything occurs to you.
Firstly, Ted Nugent, the charming Ted Nugent to Tom Vickers of Rolling Stone, 1976. Everybody should carry a gun. Every time two assholes argue, one or both will shoot each other. For the first 20 years everyone is armed, there'll be an absurd amount of unnecessary deaths. But the way the situation is now, you and I can't carry them. So who's got them? Assholes. Criminals that do it against the law. If we all carried guns and were hip and on the ball like I fucking am...
Thus speaks an arsehole of the highest order.
Gary Lucas, who had to go and play guitar for a Leonard Bernstein mass in Vienna, I think it was. This is from Zoo World, 1973. We wanted someone who looked like you, John Mansiri had said. Lucky for them, I turned out to be one of the few flash rock guitarists alive who can read music. The second guitarist was a lame classical guitar player who had somehow acquired a Les Paul and had to ask me which knobs to turn. Much to my chagrin, though, I was continually asked to turn down in the loudest passages. And but one classic rejoinder from John Mansiri, wherein I bitched at the score, called for triple forte, loud in other words, and he coolly replied that Lenny didn't know you'd be playing the part. Ha ha! It's a really great piece. It's
Gary's going to pop into the office a couple of weeks.
One of our
he's going to be in town.
Lastly, I think the least interesting of all the MOR singers, Andy Williams, talking to Max Bell in the Evening Standard in 1999.
This quote.
It was a couple of years. My theme for The Godfather was such a big hit in Spain. They used my picture over Marlon Brando's in the movie theatres. Imagine, of course I met Brando. I was at his wedding. We share the same lawyer. He's a great actor, isn't he? And the closest I got to psychedelia was singing Up, Up and Away. I wore the bell-bottoms and the hip-huggers. I had slightly longer hair and sideburns. I look back now and think it was ridiculous. Why did I do that? Cary Grant didn't do that. Oh, well.
Wow.
Cary Grant didn't wear hip huggers. Well, maybe he did, actually.
That's my life.
Private life.
Up and away, my beautiful.
What have you got, Jasper?
I've got a couple of things. First of which is Sylvia Patterson in The Word, June 2003, asking, so why exactly does David Gray have this effect on women? And she says, you've one thing in common with Coldplay. Women love you. There's a sensitive poet thing officially known as the Chris Martin effect, to which David Gray reacts in mock horror. I thought it was the David Gray effect. You've taken the one thing that I've got and you've given it to someone else. He's only 22 or something. I've been banging away for fucking years. But yeah, there's a lot of women at the gigs and I don't know why. I think they've got good taste. It's quite a funny article from, you know, interview with someone whose music I don't particularly have much truck with. But, he's funny about it and just about having basically made it. Get me a million out. I want to spend today. Well, it's mind-blowing, the whole money thing. It comes incredibly slowly so that a bunch of clowns can get very rich off your money. I'm going to go to the bank and say, can you arrange it on the floor? I want to spend one day rolling in money. But I've not turned into this multi-CD buying Elton John, 20 copies of everything in a fucking supermarket trolley for 8 different houses. I still generally go to the shop, buy the paper, pint of milk, go home, watch the telly, get a bit of pasta in, go to bed. And Sylvia says, you're supposed to get a mansion in Buckinghamshire now and then never write a decent song again in your life. That's the weird thing about the music industry. Right, the boy's made it, let's offer him more money than he'd ever get his head around, and that'll be the biggest disincentive for creativity ever. Meet you in rehab in 2 years' time. Right. Which I think is, you know, quite...
It's a good point.
I once played football with David Gray before he was famous, which obviously he isn't really anymore, but that moment... we had a game on Clapham Common, and he showed up when he was a very ordinary bloke, and actually quite dirty, as I recall.
So dirty as a footballer?
Yeah, dirty as, yeah, quite sort of aggressive.
Slide tackles.
Quite aggressive. Slide tackles.
Yeah.
And then lastly, Slept on Soul, Michael A. Gonzalez's Soulhead column, this time about Terence Trent D'Arby's Neither Fish Nor Flesh. As Michael A. Gonzalez's pieces always are, it's a really great read, and he kind of looks back on Terence Trent D'Arby, Sananda Maitreya, goes back to 1987. Back then, D'Arby was the talk of London town, and the British music press couldn't get enough of the cocky soul man. Featuring the Enemy, Melody Maker and The Face, he was hyped for months prior to his first singles coming out. The media played up D'Arby's narrative as an ex-army man who adopted England as his home and was a complete musical genius, as though Al Green and Willie Mitchell became one person, and took himself quite seriously. Meanwhile, across the ocean in New York City, I was an aspiring music critic who journeyed every Friday afternoon to a newsstand in Times Square that sold UK music publications. Like Maitreya, I had an intellectual crush on those cultural scribes who were smarter, more creative and better writers than their American counterparts. While Maitreya cited Brit critics Nick Kent, Charles Murray and Julie Burchell as his favourites, my own textual style and literary sensibilities were shaped by pop philosophers / new journalists Frank Owen, Simon Reynolds and the Studd Brothers. Mixing Foucault with their funk and post-structuralism with their Smiths, they wrote sprawling, sexy and often poetic stories and critiques about all forms of popular music. Part gonzo wild children of the revolution, part overread intellectual nerds, these salaried situationists could make musical careers, break spirits and incite violence or tears with just one of their mini manifestos.
That's fantastic.
Which, well, I just think is just wonderfully written and a fantastic kind of
Michael, if you're listening, we want you on the podcast. Can we just say
he has been invited.
He's been invited. Well, Michael, if you're listening, we want you on the podcast.
Love his writing
he
so
said
much.
No.
Actually, Frank Owen then went over to America and became a bit major writer on things like Spin and other papers like that. A terrific writer, Frank Owen.
That's that.
That brings us to the end of the episode. We'll be back in a fortnight with Stefan Shirazi talking about, among other things, Metallica, and Jack Cassidy of the Jefferson Airplane, who turns 80 very soon. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whichever platform you use. And please give us a review if you can. It really helps. Do also visit Rock's Back Pages, where subscribers can read over 50,000 articles and listen to over 800 audio interviews with everyone from Jimi Hendrix to Kurt Cobain to Kate Bush. Check to see if your local library or academic institution subscribes to RBP, and if it doesn't, maybe suggest they take a free trial of the world's largest archive of music journalism. And on that note, it's a huge thank you from me and all of us to you, Sean, for joining us.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
For all of us.
Do go and buy, you know, all the High Llamas albums, especially the new one, Hey Panda, and go see them when they play in October and wherever they're coming to a town near you, town to town. So on that note, it's
goodbye.
That concludes episode 174 of the Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Sean O'Hagan. The High Llamas' new album, Hey Panda, is out now. Visit highllamas.com or your local record shop to get your hands on it. Those were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.